Let's talk sports. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'll be reading to you today from the USA Today Sports Weekly for February 4th through February 10th. Guess what the main subject is, folks? There seems to be a big football game coming up, and for some reason, there are just a few articles in this week's newspaper about that. So we'll start with one by Jacob Russo, who writes for the Providence, Rhode Island Journal, and also for the USA Today Network. Here we go. The New England Patriots might have a twin. Their Super Bowl 60 date, the Seattle Seahawks, have a similar identity that has led both clubs to Santa Clara, California, for their February 8th showdown. It's a rematch of Super Bowl 49, and we'd all be fortunate to witness a comparable ending. Pat's defensive back Malcolm Butler left everyone remembering where they were when he sprung in front of Russell Wilson's goal line pass. And retired running back Marshawn Lynch is still wondering why then head coach Pete Carroll didn't give him the ball. Seattle moved on from Carroll last year and made Mike McDonald the youngest head coach in the NFL. McDonald is known for his defensive mind that was built over 9 seasons with the Baltimore Ravens, including 2 as its defensive coordinator. Mike Vrabel, in his first season as the head coach of the Patriots, rebuilt a historic franchise in 2025. It's always defense first with the former New England linebacker, and the Patriots have allowed just 2 touchdowns in these playoffs. Improved quarterback play keyed their seedings as the Seahawks finished first in the NFC and the Patriots netted the number 2 spot in the AFC. Sam Darnold's career revitalization with the Minnesota Vikings landed him a 3-year deal with Seattle this past offseason. Drake May played to his number 3 overall pick expectations in year 2 and is in contention for the league's MVP honor. Seattle is first in the league in scoring on defense, 3rd on offense, Vrabel said last week. Good mix of veterans and youth. Anytime that you have defenses that are good and at keeping points down, it makes it real difficult. They disguise well, they blitz, and sometimes they get pressure with just rushing 4. There are more similarities and matchups to watch for after the kickoff, which is slated for 6:30 p.m. on Sunday the 8th. New England has largely ignored outside critics this season. The Patriots landed Just May and Marcus Jones as a punt returner on the AP All-Pro second team. They were without a first-team selection, despite a 14-3 mark in the regular season. It's a balanced team that has thrived on its doubters, real or otherwise. I'm not much into the grays, Vrabel quipped about his defense. It's good enough for us to win. I think I always loved the draft grades and the offensive line and defensive line grades. I'm not much into grades. I'm just into winning. Seattle, though, had plenty of names earn NFL honors. Receiver Jackson Smith-Njigba is the only first-team pick for either team, and the 23-year-old made it in unanimous fashion. Smith-Njigba posted 1,793 yards on 119 catches with 10 touchdowns this season. He has 13 catches for 172 yards and 2 touchdowns in Seattle's 2 playoff victories. Tackle Leonard Williams, linebacker Ernest Jones IV, and cornerback Devin Witherspoon made the second team from Seattle's defense. And punter Michael Dixon received recognition from the AP. Offensively, it's a mix of some of the West Coast stuff, Vrabel said. Darnold's ability to operate and function, and not many people slow down Smith-Njigba. Kenneth Walker III, the speed, he can hit the edge and he's not afraid to cut up. They've got an excellent special teams unit. That special teams has won them some football games. If NFL honors are any indication as to which team has the better roster, Seattle certainly has the edge. They are a 4.5-point favorite, but the game still needs to be won, and bragging rights take a team only so far. Sometimes it was defense making the play, McDonald said after the NFC Championship game. A lot of times it was offense coming in and making the play. Special teams. That's what we believe. We believe that our team is our edge, how we play together. Christian Gonzalez was one of the Patriots stars who were left off the major postseason honors lists. He made the AP's second team last season and might have his most important task to date against Smith Jigba. Former head coach Bill Belichick was the master of taking away an opposing team's best player, and the Patriots will need to dial up that attack. If someone else on the Seahawks defeats you, tip your cap to Seattle. But Gonzalez and the defense should know where Smith Jigba is on every play. We'll have to play better than we played last week for us to win, Vrabel said. Situationally, and whatever is presented to us, whether that's a short yardage stop or a red zone stop, those things will have to continue to improve. The red zone has been better in the playoffs, but the only thing that's going to matter is what happens next Saturday. Seattle receiver Cooper Kupp is second in postseason receptions with 9 catches for 96 yards. The veteran was a Super Bowl MVP, but he's in the twilight of his career. Rashid Shaheed has just 1 catch in the playoffs, a 51-yard reception in the NFC Championship game. He's a speedster who could make a difference as a returner on special teams. I'm not surprised, McDonald said of Smith Jigba. Just like Darnold, we need those efforts for us to be productive on offense and happy for Smith Jigba. Guy is an absolute stud. Kenneth Walker has assumed a bell cow role in Seattle's offensive backfield, with Zach Charbonnet out for the season with an ACL injury. Walker has 178 rush yards on 38 carries with 4 touchdowns in the playoffs. He's also the third leading receiver on the team with 78 yards on 7 catches. Seattle doesn't have much behind Walker in the backfield, so stopping the 25-year-old would put more pressure on Darnold to deliver consistently. I'm happy for him, McDonald said. He's just worked. Now he's had an opportunity to really carry the load, and he's doing a great job. We're going to need him for one more game. Patriots linebacker Robert Spillane played just 13 snaps in the AFC Championship game after leaving with an ankle injury. Linebacker Jack Gibbons played well in a larger role for New England against the Broncos, but it will take the entire defense to limit Walker. They've done everything we've asked them to do, Vrabel said last week. I think being around the players helps, and again, we've got a lot more time to spend together this week and then the next week in San Francisco. Neither team made the playoffs last year. They were both long shots to win the Super Bowl at the start of the year, and yet here they are. It might just be house money on the line for both franchises, but somebody must win, and it'll be the quarterbacks who decide the outcome. May hasn't been sharp over 3 games for New England. He made the winning play when he needed to with a run for a first down against the Broncos, and his rushing skills have provided another dimension, but he needs to be better for the Pats. Just the defenses in general, not the pass rush, Vrabel said regarding May's struggle. And again, a lot of that stuff is, we'll have to play better. We'll just have to be better. We'll have to play one of our best games, if not our best game against Seattle, to stay balanced, to run the football, to use our complementary passing game and not just turn it into a drop-back passing game. Darnold is far removed from 2019 and quarterbacking for the New York Jets, which is when he was caught saying he was seeing ghosts during a blowout loss to New England. He's a true veteran playing for his 5th NFL team. He enters with some championship experience as a backup for the San Francisco 49ers team that lost to the Kansas City Chiefs in Super Bowl 58. He hasn't made any critical mistakes in the playoffs, but New England could do itself a favor by putting Seattle in a hole early. It'll be important that we're sound, Vrabel said. Darnold's been very efficient. Again, everybody's journey is different, so you give him a lot of credit for the places that he's been and how he's learned and grown. He's certainly making the most of his opportunity now. Now, here's a short rundown from Jack McKessie from USA Today on recent Patriots-Seahawks matchups. The Seahawks have won all but one of their last 5 matchups against the Patriots, but the one exception was the most significant game of the bunch. 11 years ago, New England defeated Seattle in Super Bowl 49 in a game most remembered for Patriots cornerback Malcolm Butler's interception of the goal line in the final moments. Outside of the two teams' one matchup with a Lombardi trophy on the line, the Seahawks have dominated most of the recent matchups. Here's how the last five interconference meetings between these two teams have gone. 24, Seahawks 23, Patriots 20. That was in overtime. In 20, the Seahawks won 35-30. And in 16, the Seahawks won 31-24. Then there's that Super Bowl 49 where the Patriots won 28-24. But in 2012, the Seahawks won again 24-23. Seattle has dominated the most recent head-to-head matchups between the two teams as it did against the Patriots throughout the 90s when the Seahawks won five straight interconference matchups. That has given Seattle an 11-8 edge in the regular season and an 11-9 advantage, including Super Bowl 49. Despite the Seahawks playing 25 seasons in the AFC, Seattle and New England never met in the playoffs during that span. The Seahawks moved to the NFC in the NFL's 2002 realignment. As two teams in opposite conferences now, the Seahawks and Patriots' only possible postseason meeting is in the Super Bowl. Seattle and New England have faced off in the big game only once before, 11 years ago. The Patriots came away with a win and a whirlwind of a game littered with highlights for both teams. Seattle picked off quarterback Tom Brady twice after Brady had only thrown two interceptions in his last five Super Bowl appearances combined. Brady went on to set a new NFL record with his 12th and 13th Super Bowl touchdown passes to surpass Joe Montana, completing a 10-point fourth-quarter comeback in the process. Seahawks receiver Jermaine Kearse made one of the greatest catches in Super Bowl history with just over 1 minute left, but Butler wiped it out nearly immediately with his goal line interception. New England won 28-24 after Butler's first career interception, putting the game on ice, and Brady got his fourth of what would eventually be seven Super Bowl rings. Now let's hear what John Rook, who's written a piece to the Providence Journal, has to say. It is true that this New England Patriots season has been nothing short of amazing. Back to respectability? Check. Contending status? Check again. Division champ? Had to stop and remind myself of that one. Triple check. But an actual bona fide Super Bowl contender and potential champ? For an NFL record 12th time going after a record 7th Lombardi trophy? You're kidding. After all, this Patriots team finished 4-13 each of the last two seasons, and franchise fortunes had regressed to the pre-Bill Parcells years of the early 1990s. Some of you maybe will remember those days. This is, however, the modern-day National Football League. It is the most powerful, most popular professional sports organization on the planet, with all due respect to the English Premiership. The attention, ratings, and cold hard cash generated by the league's 32 games and fans of those teams brings in $23 billion annually, nearly three times the world's best soccer league. The magic behind the NFL? That anyone can win on any given day. That losers can become winners again, and sometimes it can be a sudden change, right, Pats fans? The secret is in the parody the league has developed. Some might call it P-A-R-O-D-Y instead. But the rules are set up to get healthy if your team isn't, to be competitive if your team hasn't been, and to ultimately win if you have foresight and a little luck in your corner. These Patriots have foresight, enough to hire Mike Vrabel after making Jared Mayo their choice as head coach. And they certainly have luck. Ask the other 31 NFL teams about that. Vrabel has been brilliant. The players he brought in have bought in. And we have deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra might have said, turning our historical clock back in time to the early 2000s, when a dynastic team and organization were first born. The NFL is set up, if you don't screw it up, to put you back on top. The Patriots have simply followed the formula and had success with it. Worst to first has become more than a catchy slogan. This is the game of football today. Recently, Washington won four games in 23 and reached the NFC title game the next season. Philadelphia was 7-9 in 2016, but won the big one in 2017. You remember Nick Foles, am I right? And what about the 2001 Patriots going 5-11 in Belichick's first year to beating the Los Angeles Rams' greatest show on turf the next? Yes, an easier schedule helped start the current juggernaut that helped this team plow its way through three of the top five defenses in the league this postseason. Sure, you pick higher in the draft and you receive first options often in free agency, but you still need to choose wisely. The Patriots' foresight to bring in Vrabel with his mix of experience and familiarity with the Patriot way, whatever that is, from his time as a Super Bowl winning player, has been the gasoline to fuel the fire. And Drake May's quarterback play is the match that lit the fire. Luck? Perhaps. Smart thinking? Probably. Good coaching? Absolutely. Not every team or organization has these ingredients. It's why you see teams such as the Falcons, Titans, and Jets flounder from season to season because they miss out on one or more of these traits. I think it's time for a couple of stories on the Seahawks, or at least from the Seahawks' perspective. First, we have Dom Skane, who apparently writes for Seahawks Wire, but also for USA Today. The Seattle Seahawks run game turned a corner down the stretch, right when Justin Outen and Michael Byrne took over the duties of coaching the running backs. The team started the season with Kennedy Polamalu as their running backs coach, but he left the team in the middle of the season due to personal reasons. While seeming unfortunate, it became one of the best things that could have happened. As the tenured veteran finally got a break from coaching, two young, fresh football minds got a chance to step up and be utilized in ways that weren't even planned. And the results were great right away. Outen added running back coach to his role as run game specialist, and offensive assistant Michael Byrne did just that, assisting him, when the Seahawks needed someone to pick up the duties as running backs coach. Outen had done both of those roles before with the Titans in 23, while Byrne is an assistant who Kubiak liked enough to bring with him from the New Orleans Saints. Then, after a tough stretch in November and December, the run game was suddenly revitalized. Kenneth Walker III is playing his best football of his career, and so was Zach Charbonnet before his injury. The offensive line is in sync with them. Most of all, though, it doesn't feel so rigid. For most of the season, the Seahawks' run plays look like an obvious inside zone or outside zone, with offensive linemen and Walker seeming to have a lack of feel for how to operate as a unit. Once Outen and Byrne took over, all of the offensive linemen have been worthy of praise. Jalen Sundell is constantly getting in great spaces. Gray Zabel is rapidly ascending. Those two look like one of the most athletic and stout interior combos in the NFL. Josh Jones played amazing with Charles Cross out for the final 3 weeks of the regular season, and even undrafted free agent Amari Kite looked ready in the playoffs. The running plays might still just be variants of inside and outside zone, but it sure looks like there are a few more power run plays in there as well that get Walker going and allow him to find a groove early. The players deserve all the praise they get, but it'd be impossible to tell this story without mentioning the feel for the game that's night and day from 2 months ago. And that comes down to coaching. And Outen and Byrne seem like the difference. And Mr. Skane has another article on another player, rather this time a player, not the coaches, from the Seattle side. Nick Imanwori has become a different beast down the stretch for the Seattle Seahawks. While he was good early on, despite missing weeks 2 through 4, he also had a few growing pains playing the game-changing nickel safety position. As expected, he had to develop a sense of when to trigger early on certain routes in the passing game and when to sit back to avoid being baited by savvy NFL offenses aiming to use his athleticism against him. What no one expected was how quickly the game clicked for him at this spot. The first Los Angeles Rams game in Week 11 was the biggest test to that point, in which he sat back and played it more cautiously. Pro Football Focus grades, which aim to see players follow their assignments and err on the side of safety, gave him an 85.4 coverage grade, his highest until last week. This is when the game truly started to slow down for him, and he started to make several impact plays every week. In Week 14, visiting the Falcons in Atlanta, Emenwori broke out. He made more game-changing plays than ever before, blocking a field goal, grabbing his first interception, and capping it off with a tackle for loss and a sack. PFF graded this his worst performance of the season at 53.2 minus, because he was trying to make plays that would have been a mistake for any other player at his position to even attempt. His athleticism and instincts started to marry to his own uniqueness. In the NFC Championship game, Emenwori brought everything together. He tied his season high with three pass breakups while playing extremely disciplined coverage, giving the Rams nothing and taking everything. He wrecked the plan of arguably the best game planner and executor, Sean McVay and Matthew Stafford, in the league. To top it all off, PFF graded it his highest game yet at 89.5. He's the only one who can play a role like this for the Seahawks defense. Leonard Williams has been their best player all season. Devin Witherspoon and Ernest Jones IV are also all pros, and DeMarcus Lawrence crushes it on the stat sheet weekly. But if there's one piece who feels the least replaceable heading into the Super Bowl, it's Emenwori. So now let's hear the scouting report from another USA Today writer, Christian DeAndre. When the Patriots pass, Drake May was the NFL's most efficient quarterback in the regular season. He's been a bit of a mess, however, against a playoff schedule loaded with smothering pass rushes. He's been sacked 10 times his last two games, piling up negative plays and third and long situations that threaten to derail the New England Super Bowl aspirations. He's still managed to shine when needed the most. May's dual threat capabilities were on full display this season, the postseason that is, but his best quality is downfield efficiency. His 151.2 expected points added, known as an EPA, led all players in 2025 roughly 28 points ahead of second place Matthew Stafford. His 9.1 completion percentage over expected, that's CPOE, was tops among starting quarterbacks by a wide margin. Sorry, sports fans, those are not stats I'm used to hearing. I hope they mean something to you folks. What does that mean? May is a rising tide for a receiving corps short on stars. He'll turn to veteran Stephon Diggs on gotta have it balls and Kayshon Boutte on 50-50 shots downfield, while trusting other young teammates to move the chains. Otherwise, it'll be Hunter Henry, Mac Hollins, and the backfield duo of Ramondre Stevenson and Trevion Henderson adding value in the aerial attack. That group will fend for oxygen against the NFL's top defense. The Seahawks had a top 5 pressure rate and a bottom 10 blitz rate. A pass rush led by DeMarcus Lawrence and Leonard Williams can induce chaos in the pocket without sacrificing extra defenders. All-pros Devin Witherspoon and Ernest Jones IV, as well as rookie missile safety Nick Emenwori, can clean things up from the second level. The edge goes to the Seahawks, barring a May revival. When the Seahawks passed, like in 24, Sam Darnold finished a remarkable regular season in a slump. His production dropped off as the postseason approached. He played well enough after being spotted a 7-0 lead before ever touching the ball in a divisional rout of the depleted San Francisco 49ers. A swarming Los Angeles Rams defense offered a much different challenge. Darnold carved them up for 346 yards and 3 touchdowns to earn his place in Super Bowl 60. While his primary weapon is Jackson Smith Jigba, he of a league-high 1,793 receiving yards this season, and the 10-catch performance to clinch the NFC title, the Seahawks have gotten productive turns from Cooper Kupp and tight end A.J. Barner. Now Darnold faces a Patriots defense that has been brutal to quarterbacks this postseason. New England can counter Smith-Jigba with all-pro cornerback Christian Gonzalez, and a defense that has recorded a dozen sacks in three playoff games. Opponents have scored 26 total points against the Pats in that stretch. This edge goes to the Patriots, but Smith-Jigba may shift this on his own. When the Patriots run, New England paired a resurgent Stevenson with electric rookie Henderson to create a viable tailback platoon. The Patriots' 4.4 yards per carry ranked 14th among NFL teams, but that undersells their late season improvement. Over the first half of the season, the team's minus 0.212 EPA per carry was 31st in the league. But after week 10, its 0.43 EPA per rush clocked in at third best, aided by May's scrambling ability. That's nice, but the Seahawks have been a fairy tale monster against the run. No defense in the league allows fewer yards per carry than Seattle's 3.7. Cracks began to show after Los Angeles tailbacks picked up just under 5 yards per handoff in the NFC title game, but the Rams' Kyron Williams, Blake Corum platoon is a step above New England's young duo. The edge goes to the Seahawks. When the Seahawks run, Seattle's tailback rotation was dealt bad news when Zach Charbonnet suffered a torn ACL earlier in the playoffs. Kenneth Walker out-touched him during the regular season and is generally a bit more electric as a runner. His 9.6 carries per broken tackle ranked 8th among full-time running backs, even if his .17 rushing yards over expected and 4.6 yards per carry leave him firmly in good but not great territory. The returns of Milton Williams and Robert Spillane have bolstered an above-average run defense up the middle for the Patriots. Denver's running backs gained only 54 yards against them on 19 carries, albeit on a slick, snowy field through the second half. So the edge here is rated as even. Special teams. New England rookie Andres Borealis missed 2 field goals in the AFC title game, but that was in snow and swirling winds. Weather doesn't totally excuse the issues punter Bryce Behringer had. After a solid regular season, he averaged fewer than 38 yards per kick in the thin air of Mile High Stadium and only had a single punt down inside the 20-yard line. The Seahawks counter with Jason Myers, a steady veteran who attempted more field goals than anyone in 2025. He's flanked by Michael Dixon, an all-pro punter who can regularly drop awkwardly spinning punts inside the 5-yard line. Both sides have dynamic returners who can flip a game in the Patriots' Marcus Jones and Seahawks' Rashid Shaheed. But the edge goes to the Seahawks. Now for coaching. Mike Vrabel's first year as a coach in New England has landed him in the same place he finished half his 8 seasons as a linebacker with that franchise. The man who once took the Tennessee Titans 1 win from a Super Bowl turned the Patriots from a 4-win laughingstock to AFC champions. Mike McDonald has only been a head coach 2 years. He is 25-10 in that small sample size and has yet to lose a playoff game. He parlayed his reputation as a defensive savant with the Baltimore Ravens into the architect of the league's scariest defense in Seattle. Edge, it goes to Vrabel by experience, but it's close call. Now the venue, Santa Clara, California. It's about 3,000 miles from Foxborough, Mass., and it's a little more than 800 miles from Seattle. So the edge goes to the Seahawks, assuming their fans can shell out for the priciest tickets in live sports. Who's hot? Sam Darnold roasted a top 10 defense with 300-plus yards and 3 touchdowns, all without a turnover. Kenneth Walker has 4 touchdowns in his last 2 games. Clavon Chason's quest for a massive 2026 payday has resulted in 3 sacks and 9 quarterback hits this postseason. Boot remains one of Drake May's most trusted and most targeted wideout. Who's not hot, that is. May enters Super Bowl 60 after throwing for 65 net passing yards in the AFC Championship game. Trevion Henderson had 5 total yards on a day New England badly needed to generate yards on the ground. Rookie left tackle Will Kimble has been thrown into the fire against some of the league's best pass rushers and been found lacking each week. Rick Woolen extended a Rams drive after getting flagged for taunting after a third down pass breakup. Then he got torched for a 49-yard touchdown the very next play. I don't know, fans. I think that does qualify as not hot. All right, let's stick with the Super Bowl as a major subject, but let's take the focus off the players just for one article here. This is by Charles Curtis, writing for USA Today Network. The headline tips it off. Tirico and Collinsworth talk respect. Mike Tirico has practically done it all as a sportscaster, with one exception. He's been a Sports Center anchor, play-by-play voice, and host of the NBA Finals, World Cups, golf majors, tennis, the Olympics, and countless football games over the last few decades. But there's one accomplishment missing from his resume until now: calling a Super Bowl in the booth. And when NBC broadcasts Super Bowl 60 in Santa Clara, he'll be on the mic, joining a short list of those who had the honor of calling NFL's title game in front of a massive TV audience. Once you start calling football games at any level, you don't even dream of calling the Super Bowl, because it's crazy to dream about that, Tirico told USA Today Sports back in January at an NBC Sports event in New York. But it's a realization of a lifetime of work. On the other side of him will be Chris Collinsworth, a man with 5 Super Bowls as analyst already under his belt. It's their partnership, a seamless transition after Collinsworth starred with Al Michaels for 13 years, that has enhanced Sunday Night Football. There's an added challenge for Tirico. He'll start February calling Sunday Night Basketball, continue with the Super Bowl, and then go right into the Olympics after the NFL champion gets crowned. He doesn't see it as daunting as it might seem on paper, especially since, as he noted, his prep work for those events started long before the date approached. For him, it's an honor. No one is lucky enough to have that opportunity to do all those things in one stretch, he said. In some ways, I look at it as a marathon, but it'll go by like a sprint. According to Collinsworth, there is no one who's more ready for that stretch than Tirico. He's just such a good human being and has one of the most amazing brains, Collinsworth said. Do you know how hard it is to follow the NFL, period? Now he's going to stack on the Olympics and then the NBA. That's impossible. If you want to say who's the biggest sports fan in America, he said, noting Tirico watches baseball or hockey in his time off, I would have my nominee. Tirico and Collinsworth had some experience together before their SNF partnership began in 22, with a few NFL games as partners. But it's felt like they've been together on the air forever. They both talk about all the time they spend with each other that goes beyond Sunday nights during the season. The mutual respect they have for each other is obvious. If you say something to him, it's now in his computer brain, Collinsworth said. If you show a video of his technique or a technique, it's in his brain. He's a sponge and he wants more. He always wants more. Collinsworth pointed out how in awe he is of that computer brain. He remembers Tirico's 2023 call of defensive end Sam Hubbard running back a fumble 98 yards for a touchdown in the Cincinnati Bengals' wildcard win over the Baltimore Ravens. Tirico brought excitement, details, and backstory all in a minute and a half thrill ride, while weaving in the fact that Hubbard was a Cincinnati native who grew up a Bengals fan. Tirico also had nothing but love for his broadcast partner, calling him the easiest person to get along with. So now I'm going to take the attention off of the big game and focus on the big controversy based on an article by Jarrett Bell, who's a columnist with USA Today. His headline is, I'm a Pro Football Hall of Fame voter. We blew it with the Belichick snub. What an embarrassment. Like so many others, I'm stunned that Bill Belichick was not selected on the first ballot for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. If winning six Super Bowls as New England Patriots coach, more than any coach in history, doesn't ensure induction, then nothing will. I'm embarrassed too, because the selection committee I've been honored and privileged to be a part of for 29 years really missed the mark. Yes, for the record, I voted for Belichick as the lone finalist for the coaching category. I supported Mike Holmgren in that category last year and think that still overlooked Mike Shanahan and Tom Coughlin deserve the glory of busts in Canton, Ohio, too. Please don't tell me Belichick having Tom Brady, who vouches for the impact the coach had on his development as the most prolific winner during the Super Bowl era, diminishes his case. Yet, somehow, at least 11 voters from our 50-member panel did not vote for Belichick, leaving him short of the 80% needed for selection. So, what happened? During our marathon 8-hour selection meeting on Zoom recently, we thoroughly discussed Belichick's record and the controversies of Spygate and Deflategate. Of all the candidates, which included 15 modern-day player finalists, a contributor, Patriots owner Robert Kraft, and three seniors nominees, Ken Anderson, Roger Craig, and L.C. Greenwood, the discussion of Belichick was one of the longest. Hey, I was in the room when Joe Montana was up for the class of 2000. At that time, the meetings were held in person the day before the Super Bowl. And the scribe presenting Super Joe, Ira Miller of the San Francisco Chronicle, stood up and used one sentence to make his case. Something to the effect of, "I present Joe Montana." Then Ira sat down. In other words, it was a no-brainer. Sure, Belichick's case is a lot more complex than Montana's was, given the discipline that's on his record for secretly filming the hand signals used on the New York Jets sideline in 2007. He was fined $500,000, largest ever for an NFL coach, and the Patriots were docked $250,000 in addition to the loss of a first-round draft pick. Yet, even with that blemish, it seemed that Belichick was a no-brainer too as a first-ballot pick for the Hall, or so I thought. In the ESPN report on January 27th that revealed the Belichick snub, 9 days before the Hall officially revealed its class of 26 during the NFL Honor Show, Hall of Fame General Manager Bill Polian was characterized as an influential force who wanted Belichick to wait a year as penance for Spygate. That certainly wasn't expressed by Polian during our Zoom call, and Polian vehemently denied the allegation from an anonymous voter, according to ESPN.com, that he led a charge to keep Belichick's out in a sidebar conversation with voters. That's unequivocally false, Polian told USA Today Sports. Sure, you can suspect that Polian had motivation. During his years as the Indianapolis Colts GM, the rivalry with the Patriots was intense. Many point to Polian, then a member of the NFL's competition committee, for the crackdown on enforcing illegal contact penalties, given how star Patriots cornerback Ty Law bullied Colts receiver Marvin Harrison. And Deflategate, remember, was ignited by the underinflated footballs that Brady used in the 2015 AFC Championship game against the Colts. Now, consider this. Even if Polian, a big supporter of Kraft, didn't support Belichick's case, it still took at least 11 voters from the panel to deny entry. Given the relatively new rules that pit the finalists from the coaching category against the contributor finalist and three seniors category finalists, this is deeper than merely casting Polian as the arch-villain. "I was shocked that he didn't get in," Polian told me. "He deserves to be in the Hall without question. He's eminently qualified. I'm sorry he didn't get in. I look forward to voting for him next time." Next year, that is. Regardless, some serious damage has been done here. Keeping Belichick out, at least for now, takes some shine off those who will be ultimately presented as the Hall's newest class. Even worse, as the most significant snub in my ears in this mix, it has left a stain on the Hall of Fame that unnecessarily fuels questions about its legitimacy. I mean, Bill Cowher, Tony Dungy, and Don Coryell are in the Hall of Fame and Belichick is not? That's not a knock on the other coaches elected under a different set of voting rules, but Belichick's 333 victories, second only to Don Shula's 347, counts for a whole lot. Hall coach Jimmy Johnson, it tarnishes everybody. It tarnishes everybody associated with the Hall of Fame. Jimmy Johnson, who won two Super Bowls with the Dallas Cowboys and was inducted into the Hall in 21, told USA Today Sports, "They can't kick me out, but he deserves to be in before me." Johnson was so hot about it when we talked on January 28th. Granted, they are tight. Belichick has made several treks to the Florida Keys to hang and fish with Johnson, typically wanting to talk shop while Johnson wants him to unplug. When they saw each other recently at the College National Championship game, Johnson told Belichick that he would see him in Canton at the induction ceremony in August, and he made arrangements for a chartered plane to get there. "Well, I canceled that plane," Johnson said. Johnson maintains that Belichick's achievements are more impressive than other coaching legends because they come in an era of the salary cap and free agency, and that's not counting the two Super Bowl rings he won as defensive coordinator with the New York Giants. "No one knows the history and loves the NFL more than Bill Belichick," Johnson added. "That's why I'm so upset." Johnson has so much company in the ticked-off department. Shoot, I'm a bit ticked, a bit, that so many want to lump the entire selection committee as one monolithic body. No, that's not how it works. The voters, largely made up of journalists, have the free will to make their independent selections. While the Hall's bylaws stipulate that we are to only consider what occurs on the field, there is some gray area with interpretation. It's possible, too, that some voters didn't support Belichick as a matter of conscience, given the cheating scandal represented with Spygate. I'm also thinking that the voting requirement for the special categories, we are required to vote for three of the five candidates from the coach, contributor, and seniors categories, threw a wrench into the equation for Belichick. There are voters who are passionate about seniors nominees, thinking they get short shrift after not becoming Hall of Famers after 20 years of eligibility as modern-day candidates. Sure, some seniors candidates may have slipped through the cracks, but to stack the deck with three seniors candidates each year is a recipe that makes it much tougher on deserving coaches and contributors. Count me in the crowd that favors transparency with the voting. If there's a reason to vote for one candidate over another, let the explanations flow. In the meantime, there's no shortage of feedback from the internet mob. Intense, vile, below the belt, passionate, all of that. Yet, it's also ironic that despite his reputation for being anything but Mr. Congeniality, Belichick has proved to be quite a unifier on social media. There's overwhelming noise contending that we got it so wrong. To that point, I can hardly disagree. Next, we have a longish article titled "Making Sense of the 10 Head Coach Hires." I'm not going to read every one of them, but I'm going to read a few that I would think would be of more general interest. This column is by Michael Middlehurst Schwartz. One of the wildest NFL coaching carousels in league history has finally come to a standstill, at least for the top position. With 10 head coaching vacancies popping up, the onset of the offseason was far more active than anyone could have anticipated. But after the Las Vegas Raiders closed in on Clint Kubiak and the Arizona Cardinals hired Mike LaFleur on Sunday the 1st, every opening has been accounted for less than a month after the movement first started to ramp up. Given the myriad unknowns and extenuating circumstances when assessing what went right or wrong at the very top for any team, evaluating head coaching hires, particularly first-timers, can be notoriously difficult. With that said, here is our initial ranking of all the coaching hires. Well, he's ranked John Harbaugh with the New York Giants as number one, so I'll read that. On Black Monday, it seemed as though this year's candidate pool lacked the equivalent of a Mike Vrabel or Ben Johnson. One day later, John Harbaugh was thrown into the mix and became the clear headliner. Expecting the former Ravens coach to replicate what the New England Patriots or Chicago Bears achieved in year one of their new regimes would be unreasonable. Still, Harbaugh's track record, just three losing seasons in 18 years, is the stuff of dreams for a Giants franchise tied for the fewest wins since 2017. Only 44. Wow. Harbaugh was the one option this cycle who looked capable of flipping an organization's culture, even if it required some uncomfortable shifts. Given how set in their ways the Giants have been, the transformation might not take place overnight, but Big Blue has seen sharp play callers flame out, so inspiring hope was going to necessitate finding someone capable of addressing the very core of the organization. In Harbaugh, they now have that. His number two choice for these coaching changes is Jesse Minter with the Ravens. Parting with Harbaugh only to turn to a family disciple might seem like a strange move. But in hiring Jesse Minter, Baltimore can hold on to much of what worked for the previous regime while still finding a fresh voice and direction for the franchise. Wildly lauded for both his schematic acumen and his ability to connect with others, Minter already has an extensive track record of bringing along young players. That no doubt was a major draw for the Ravens team with a top-heavy roster and a firm commitment to developing homegrown talent. In Los Angeles, Minter's remaking of the defense took hold almost instantly. The Ravens might be due for a bit more upheaval on that side of the ball than they're accustomed to, but Minter could help the franchise return to its roots. At the very least, he can help the unit cut down on the considerable number of lapses that became an unfortunate running theme last season. Leaving the fate of the offense and two-time NFL MVP Lamar Jackson in the hands of Declan Doyle, the team's offensive coordinator, is a colossal gamble. But there's considerable upside after the unit seemed to hit its ceiling under Todd Monken. Now we'll skip down to coaches that I think are more in general interest in this part of the world. At number five, he's ranked the Las Vegas Raiders, hiring Clint Kubiak. The Raiders is one of those teams that nobody has a mediocre opinion of. You're either really for them or you're really against them. So, after losing out on Ben Johnson last year, the Raiders at long last have their offensive upstart to get this build in motion. Las Vegas likely had its eyes trained on one side of the ball more so than other franchises after ranking last in scoring in total yards last season, with the Silver and Black holding second interviews with Brady and Denver Broncos passing game coordinator Davis Webb. Ultimately, however, Kubiak gives the organization something even more important than offensive acumen, alignment. Turning to Pete Carroll, who became the oldest coach in NFL history upon his return to the sidelines, quickly proved to be an odd settling point for an organization that should have been seeking long-term answers rather than quick fixes. Kubiak turns 39 later this month, and there are bound to be some hiccups in his acclimation period as a first-time head coach. Nevertheless, there was no more promising offensive mind to bring aboard and to set the stage for Heisman Trophy-winning quarterback Fernando Mendoza's expected arrival as the number one pick. Between a rare run on second-chance coaches and the Seahawks' playoff push limiting his availability, Kubiak didn't end up commanding the kind of attention one might expect of a candidate with his resume. If he's able to engineer a comparable sort of instantaneous turnaround in Las Vegas, as he did in Seattle, however, this move might quickly become one of the most lauded in this cycle. Then at number six comes the Buffalo Bills hiring of Joe Brady. In a vacuum, Joe Brady is a perfectly qualified candidate who would invigorate plenty of franchises. He entered the season as one of the most prominent names on the market after deciding to stay put last winter, and his play-calling acumen might be unmatched in the thin pool of offensive-minded options. For those of you keeping track, that's at least three, maybe four uses of the word acumen by this columnist. But any assessment of the Bills' hire has to take into account the circumstances of their puzzling firing of Sean McDermott, and the even more baffling justification put forth by owner Terry Pegula and general manager Brandon Bean. Now, after giving every indication that the team needs to get over the proverbial playoff wall that Pegula referenced, the franchise is turning to a first-time head coach and, at 36, the youngest in the NFL, who was interwoven with the issues that Pegula and Bean seemed to cite as grounds for McDermott's dismissal. Pegula seemed to center Josh Allen throughout the process, including having the quarterback shape the search for McDermott's replacement. Viewed through that lens, Brady makes ample sense for Buffalo after he proved capable of orchestrating a versatile attack despite several glaring personnel limitations, particularly at receiver. Perhaps the Bills took a look around at their external options and simply weren't moved by any of the choices. It's worth noting that they were unable to speak with Seattle Seahawks offensive coordinator Clint Kubiak given the timing of McDermott's firing and the Seahawks' Super Bowl run. But after crowing about the need for change, why skew so heavily toward the familiar? There's clearly considerable upside for Brady here, but the challenge facing him is immense. Not only must he figure out a way to push Allen and the offense forward after the unit ranked fourth in both total yards and points in 25, but he'll have to do so while taking on a host of unfamiliar game management and big picture responsibilities. Bringing in Jim Leonard to lead the defense adds a bit of excitement on that side of the ball, but navigating that unit's diminishing returns in several spots could be a bit overwhelming for a first-time NFL defensive coordinator. The cap situation: Buffalo is currently projected to be nearly $14 million overdrawn, according to Over the Cap, is also a little foreboding for a team that has several key pending free agents worth keeping, and several more who should be brought in. There's a solid chance that the Bills can be a playoff mainstay and top-tier AFC contender under Brady. The problem for him, however, is that Buffalo has made clear that those accomplishments just won't suffice. My next read is number 8, where the Pittsburgh Steelers have hired Mike McCarthy. After Mike Tomlin's resignation, Chairman Art Rooney II made clear the Steelers wouldn't be undergoing a rebuild, and here's the proof. In hiring the 62-year-old McCarthy, who has a career 60.8 winning percentage and a Super Bowl title on his resume, but little postseason success to speak of in the last decade, Pittsburgh proved it prized steady stewardship above all. On some level, that's understandable for a franchise that hasn't known what it's like to be truly out of the playoff hunt in the last 20 years. McCarthy has also demonstrated that he's still a savvy play caller. His 22 and 23 offenses rank fourth and first in scoring, respectively, who has unparalleled experience in leading storied organizations after his turns with the Green Bay Packers and the Dallas Cowboys. But unlike the Giants, the Steelers on a team needing the floor to be raised, Pittsburgh has taken up residence in the AFC's second tier without much of a threat of breaking through to the first, with its postseason win drought now standing at 9 seasons. It's difficult to see how McCarthy changes that dynamic much, even if the baseline doesn't stray too far from a 500 mark. And while the stellar quarterback play that has accompanied his last two stops might be seen as a major draw for a franchise facing plenty of uncertainty behind center, there's not much to suggest he has a substantial advantage over the field in developing a young passer, a task the Steelers desperately need to embrace, but might again resist. Perhaps the most problematic element of this decision was the stretch run of the process. Pittsburgh held virtual interviews with both Los Angeles Rams defensive coordinator Chris Shula, considered by many to be a leading candidate for the role, and Rams passing game coordinator Nate Shielhaas. But rather than wait until after the NFC Championship game for the opportunity to speak in person with both, the Steelers plowed ahead with McCarthy, who hadn't been in the mix for any of the other remaining vacancies. This was the perfect opportunity for Pittsburgh to step back and consider the full scope of its options. Instead, it opted for the familiar and unthreatening choice. In the last few years, two of the more notable respectability plays for hires, the Raiders turning to Carroll last year and the Jaguars going to Doug Peterson in 22, have flamed out. McCarthy likely won't go bust at the scale that the former did. But this sure feels like a missed opportunity to make up ground on the conference's actual contenders by a franchise more concerned with the prospect of seeding it. And then at number nine, we have the Cardinals, the Arizona Cardinals, of course, hiring of Mike LaFleur. It should come as no surprise that the Cardinals were the last team to arrive at a decision for the head coach opening. Remember, this was the franchise that ranked last in the NFL Players Association's annual report card. Yes, behind even the Jets. It also stood to reason then that Arizona would again have to go a bit outside of the box in its coaching search rather than try to woo the big names who were courted by more appealing outfits. The Cardinals' choice only emerged after the team waited for a Saturday, January 31st interview with Kubiak, only to have him link up with the Raiders instead. As the franchise returns its focus back to the offensive side of the ball after Jonathan Gannon's tenure, the 38-year-old offers plenty of reasons for a franchise to take a chance on him. He's been a valued asset to both Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay, and the latter's previous three offensive coordinators, Matt LaFleur, Kevin O'Connell, and Liam Cohen, have all gone on to find resounding success in top posts. The younger LaFleur could fast-track the revitalization of a run game that ranked second in yards per carry, and he should have no trouble continuing to route the aerial attack through Trey McBride. But can Shanahan and McVay's former pupil really compete with the two of them while dealing with a substantial gap in talent and institutional support? This would have been an extremely difficult spot for any candidate, and a large swing was likely necessary. But LaFleur's track record working with Zach Wilson in New York isn't exactly inspiring for a team that could need to break in a young passer soon if it opts to move on from Kyler Murray. The timing of the move also does him few favors when it comes to compiling a staff capable of helping a first-time head coach in a difficult position, as many of the more experienced coordinator options have already been settled elsewhere. And that's going to wrap it up for me this week, sports fans. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, wishing you the best and thanking you for listening.